I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome back to Radio Times. 65 million years ago, an object slammed into the Earth, creating conditions that led to the extinction of the dinosaurs and many other species. Our guest, Lisa Randall, theorizes that that cataclysmic event could have involved dark matter. That's the stuff we can't see, smell, hear, taste, or feel that exerts a powerful influence on the universe. She's a theoretical particle physicist and cosmologist at Harvard University, and the author of best-selling books, including Knocking on Heaven's Door and Warped Passages. Her new book is Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs, The Astounding Interconnectedness of the Universe, and she joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. And Lisa Randall, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Is this a good time to be in your line of work?
Yeah, it really is a good time to be in my line of work. I have to admit that as a theoretical physicist, we sort of move to where the interesting stuff is. And right now, dark matter is a very exciting research area. There are experiments going on. There are observations in the sky. And there's a lot of theoretical ideas, which is what I do. And so combining these together makes it really interesting.
What makes this such a good time for dark matter? Is it we're so much more advanced, I guess, in our understanding?
It's experiments have reached a new level of precision. I think there's a bit of a more open-mindedness about what dark matter can be because we haven't seen it yet, oddly enough. There's many theoretical ideas. And one of the things I do as I'm a model builder. I come up with proposals. And we have these amazing astronomical observations happening now, as we'll probably get into. One of the really exciting ones is a study of stars in our own galaxy.
Right.
And you want to know what you're looking for. So having models lets you target this and figure out what's out there.
And the fact that we don't really know all that we, I guess, could know about dark matter. I mean, that's intriguing, isn't it?
That's right. And that's actually a really good point. I mean, it's kind of the ideal situation in a way because we absolutely know dark matter is there.
We do know that.
In the sense that we've observed its gravitational influence. There's definitely things that are not accounted for unless you have something else there, which is likely to be this dark matter. But we don't know precisely what dark matter is in the sense of, is it made up of elementary particles? What are the masses of those particles? Is it one type of particle? Do some of them have interactions? There's a lot of things that we can learn about the nature of this dark matter. So far, we've only observed its gravitational influence.
And why do we call it dark matter? It's because it's, I mean,
you know,
is that
I think
a misnomer?
It is in most ways. I think it was actually dark in the sense of slightly ominous, but was meant. But dark is very confusing from a physics standpoint because we see dark things.
Yes, we do.
We're both wearing black and we certainly see each other's outfits. The thing is, dark stuff absorbs light. And with dark matter, the light just passes through. I mean, I like to think that transparent might have been a better name. The light just goes through. It also does give people the idea that it's much more influential than it is. An individual dark matter particle is inconsequential. It's only because there's so much of it. There's actually five times the amount of energy in dark matter as ordinary matter. And that's why it's had such a big influence.
Which is interesting to contemplate, so that ordinary matter is such a small part, I guess, of our universe, right?
It's really funny because to me, I mean, you know, what's astounding is that ordinary matter is as big a fraction as it is. I mean, why should the matter that we experience be such a big part of the universe? After all, there's a lot out there that isn't directly related to us. But the fact that somehow, you know, despite the Copernican Revolution, every time we find out we're not central, we're not central, but even the kind of matter we are isn't central. People find it very disturbing. But at this point, we should think it's kind of obvious.
Well, I guess a little lesson in hubris, right?
Don't you think? I absolutely think so. And, you know, I think that is one of the great things about being a scientist is, you know, it's both. You know, on the one hand, it's amazing how much we as human beings can figure out.
Right.
On the other hand, we realize how insignificant in many respects we are with respect to the universe. And both are really interesting things to learn.
I do want to have you read a section from the book. And I mean, I had about 17 questions about what is dark matter? How do we understand it? But read a section from your book and then we can chat.
Okay, this is a little bit playful. When walking down the street, the sidewalks of Manhattan, or driving along the streets of Hollywood, you sometimes sense that a famous person is near. Even if you don't see George Clooney directly, the disruptive traffic generated by the waiting crowd armed with cell phones and cameras suffices to alert you to a celebrity's proximity. Though you detect the presence only indirectly, through George's substantial influence on everyone else around, you can nonetheless be confident that someone special is near. Sometimes when you walk through a forest, a flock of birds will suddenly go wild overhead, or a buck will run across your path. You might never encounter the hiker or hunter that set these animals in motion. Even so, the motion of the animals introduces the sportsman and helps to tell their story. We don't see dark matter, but, like the celebrity or the hunter, it influences its surroundings.
The idea of George Clooney, sort of the waves, sort of it, people are responding to something like
that. That's right. I think the analogy really does work, because we know dark matter is there because it influences other things, but we don't know exactly what it is.
Right.
And similarly, if you saw all those cell phones, you would know someone's there, but you don't know who it is. You know it's some famous person. And so we know this thing is there. It's exerting a gravitational influence. But as scientists, mm-hmm. we really want to figure out, what is it?
Well, as you say, a gravitational influence.
Right.
Describe what you mean by that.
So we've actually, quote unquote, observed dark matter in many different ways. And one of the first ways we knew about dark matter's existence was because the gravitational attraction of dark matter influences the motion of stars. And stars in our galaxy, for example, move so quickly that they would fly out of the galaxy unless there was a bigger restoring potential established by matter.
Hmm.
And if it was only ordinary matter, there wouldn't be enough of it to keep those stars circulating at those speeds. So the speed of the stars, the rotational speeds of the stars, tells us that there's matter we're not observing, which is, in fact, the dark matter. But dark matter has other influences, too. It influences the motion of light. So when you look at a light object, a bright object that emits light, with dark matter in between, you might see multiple images of that object because light will bend differently around it. So there's many different ways at this point that we've, quote unquote, observed dark matter. And again, it's not directly. It's through its gravitational influence on light or stars or other forms of matter.
And what is dark energy then?
Dark energy is another slightly confusing name. But dark energy is energy that's not carried by matter. Now, that might sound confusing,
mm-hmm.
but Einstein taught us that energy itself matters in the sense that it affects how things evolve, like it affects cosmology, for example. So there could be just a background energy, even if no actual matter is present. There can be an actual energy. And what was found that told us that dark energy was present is that the acceleration of the universe, which I remind you was established only within about a century, but that expansion is actually accelerating. That was actually a surprising result. When people set out to measure this, they actually were trying to measure a deceleration parameter. But they measured instead that the expansion of the universe is accelerating. And that acceleration is caused by this, again, somewhat mysterious form of energy known as dark energy.
And expanding, forever expanding?
Yeah, as far as we know, it's expanding forever. You know, I joke in the book about, you know, the big questions that sort of whatever answers you give to these questions are unsatisfying. If it stopped, that would be pretty disturbing,
it
too.
Would.
Somehow expanding forever seems like a less unsatisfying answer to that. So, yes, according to what we think, it is expanding forever, and that rate is accelerating.
Does this help us understand the Big Bang? I mean, sort of what happened at the beginning?
Well, so, you know, it's interesting. I mean, the Big Bang is a very successful theory, and the expansion of the universe. We've measured cosmic microwave background radiation left over from the beginning. But the thing that the Big Bang theory does not tell us is what banged, what was the beginning. It tells us how the universe evolved afterwards, so we can study. And it tells us pretty quickly afterward. But at the very beginning, we don't know what happened. And that's, again, one of these big philosophical questions.
So we know what happened in that nanosecond after the Big Bang, but we don't know what caused
something
to bang, right?
Right. And there's different, again, sort of philosophical viewpoints almost. And I say philosophical because we haven't found a way to distinguish them.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe there was a bang. Maybe our universe is one of many universes and they all sort of banged. You know, was there a beginning or was this always going on? Again, I find that a less unsatisfying version.
Right.
But we don't know exactly what happened. But we do know very soon afterward, something called cosmological inflation happened, which is this exponential expansion of the universe very rapidly. And it's much less than a nanosecond, probably. It's 10 to minus 38 seconds, really early on. And then that goes over to the sort of smoother, slower expansion of the Big Bang theory that we talk about.
I really like the subtitle of your book. I mean, I like the title as well, Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs, The Astounding Interconnectedness of the Universe. And what your book sort of reminds us is not just that things are interconnected, I guess, over our head, but also the role that we play in our universe.
Well, what I really wanted to get across with that, I mean, one of the reasons I was excited to write this book was I work on fairly abstract things. I mean, it is physics. It does apply to the world. But it's, you know, elementary particles, dark matter. And what I really got excited about was this idea that you could have this concrete influence on the world that surrounds us. Of course, I knew that all along, and we know that. Mm-hmm. But to really study this and to actually tell one big story, not just a story of one individual part of physics, but the big story about the cosmology, how the universe evolved, what dark matter is, but then to move on to the galaxy itself and the solar system and stars and the solar system and the planet and life on Earth.
Yeah.
To really connect that whole story was really what I was enthusiastic about.
You had a piece in the Boston Globe recently. I'll just quote a couple of sentences near the end. People's attitude towards dark matter is bedeviled by the same instincts that influence our responses to different races, castes, or classes whom they might not truly see, but who are nonetheless essential to society. And I circled that because I thought it was really provocative and interesting.
Well, you know, it's maybe a little bit of a daring point of view, but in many ways it's not. I think the basic point, you know, it's something you see in all of physics. You know, when if I talk about stuff, you know, people will somehow think of it as less real. Mm-hmm. If I talk about scales or that are hard to see directly or matter that we don't directly observe. But this stuff is real. That's a statement about us, human beings. That stuff is out there. And I think we've gotten to the point where we understand that to make advances in science, we have to get outside our reference frame. We have to see other perspectives. And I think that it's just a useful lesson to apply to the world. I think it's good to remember that, although the stuff that is in your immediate proximity seems the most real, there's a lot of that you have to get other vantage points to really understand reality more comprehensively.
You also, you end by saying Jefferson understood that the real issue I was addressing was the transparency, both metaphorical and literal, of people phenomena. And going on from there.
Yeah, so that was referring to, actually, it was kind of an amazing story. I attended this, I was a participant in Yaddo, which is a place where artists and writers go. And I think it was their first scientist, but I was a writer also. And I did a reading the day before I was leaving of just my first chapter. And in that, I used some analogies of stuff that are really out there that we don't see, like bacteria in our bodies or internet chat rooms we don't enter. But that stuff is real. It's just not part of our daily existence. And it was interesting because originally I had actually talked about race issues and people were like, you can't do that, Lisa. That's too confusing and whatever. And I think they were right. But as I was leaving, Jefferson Pinder, who's an artist who was there, an African-American artist who was there, said, I know this sounds crazy, but were you really talking about race? And what was amazing was that I had been and I had taken it out. And I was so impressed that he was able to see through to that.
That's Lisa Randall, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. She is a cosmologist, a physicist, and author of a new book called Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs, The Astounding Interconnectedness of the Universe. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. I already see calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia, and I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Lisa Randall about her new book. It's called Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs, The Astounding Interconnectedness of the Universe. And I see calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. I guess everyone has been wondering what happened to the dinosaurs, including physicists and cosmologists.
You know, it's funny. This is outside my usual bailiwick.
Right.
And so it was really fun to go and study this. You know, everyone, you know, I think we were all around in the 80s when they first started talking about the impact hypothesis. Right. What I hadn't appreciated until I really started doing the research for this book is how well established it is now that some big object, 10 to 15 kilometers big.
Right. Came size in, you know, of a city, you say.
Yeah, size of a city. Came in, you know, 40 kilometers per second or something like that. And impacted the globe and really had global effects in ways that killed off not just the dinosaurs, but 2/3 of the species on the planet. And there's a lot of ways for stuff to die if that happens. But the evidence, though, is really in the form of what's in the rock. I mean, you can see very clearly where the transition is, where the extinction happened. You can study the types of rocks that are present. You can study what they are, but also the structure. And you can date that. And the amazing other story that I also tell because it's so amazing is actually finding the actual crater that corresponded to that impact, which wasn't guaranteed at all.
Really?
Something that hit 66 million years ago. First of all, it could have fallen in the ocean. So that's already 2/3 of the surface of the Earth. Then there could have been erosion. There could have been lots of ways that we just didn't see it. And also just the very fact that the impact was global meant that you had to be really clever to figure out where it happened. It could have been anywhere on the surface of the globe, at least in principle. And so it was really some very clever sleuthing that helped pin it down, which I love this story.
And what do you think the role of dark matter could be or was?
Well, it's a hypothesis. I don't want to overstate. I mean, so far what I said about dark matter is all pretty solid in the sense that we really do know dark matter exists. But we don't know what dark matter is. And my collaborators and I made a really pretty harmless sounding assumption, especially if you look at the matter of our universe that we know about, and said maybe not all the dark matter is the same. Maybe there's a small fraction of dark matter that can radiate. Now, probably most people don't know this. I didn't really know it till I started doing this research. But the reason there's a Milky Way plane, as opposed to just a spherical halo like there is of dark matter in our galaxy, is that ordinary matter radiates. And when it radiates, it collapses into a disk. So if there's a small fraction of dark matter that can radiate, it too can collapse into a disk. And moreover, and this was something that really no one knew before we did our research, that disk could be really narrow if that dark matter particle is heavier than a proton, which seems pretty likely. So you could have a narrow dark matter disk. Now, why would the dinosaurs care about that?
Well, exactly.
Well, it turns out there's some evidence, and again, I don't want to overstate, but there's some evidence that big impacts happen periodically. Small impacts happen all the time. Small stuff hits the Earth all the time. But big impacts seem to have about a 30 million year periodicity. Now, and people have looked for explanations for that, but none of them seem to really work. So our proposal is the following. So the solar system goes around the galaxy every 240 million years. But as it does so, it bobs up and down through the plane of the Milky Way, which would mean that on a much smaller time scale, maybe every 30, 35 million years, it would pass through this dark matter disk if it exists. And at that time, the dark matter would give it sort of an extra gravitational pull. Now, why does the solar system care? One more ingredient. Out at the very end of the solar system, about 50,000 times farther away than the Earth is from the sun, are objects in what's known as the Oort cloud. Those objects become long-period comets. But if you kick them, they're very weakly bound because they're so far away. The sun exerts much less gravitational influence on them. So if you can kick them, then something can get dislodged. So our proposal is that every 30 or 35 million years, one of those objects got dislodged, and one of them could have been the one that 66 million years ago knocked off the dinosaurs.
How do you prove something like that?
Well, it's very hard to prove that it was what killed the dinosaurs. But you can actually look for evidence of the dark disk. And to get the right periodicity, we need a certain type of disk. So we predict the properties that a disk would have to have. Well, one of the really lovely things in doing this research was we entered our research summer a couple of years ago. That fall, something called the Gaia satellite was set to launch. And that satellite was measuring a billion stars in the Milky Way, measuring their position and their velocity. And if you think about it, if there is this dark matter disk, it would affect the motion of stars through its gravitational influence. As stars go up and down through the plane of the galaxy, they would experience a different gravitational force. So by doing this large data set, doing this big measurement, we'll be able to learn about whether this disk exists and what are its properties.
Are we due for another big hit?
We are on the right side of history because we passed through the disk probably a couple million years ago if it exists. So it'll be another 30 million years. So we're okay, at least as far as that's concerned.
And with this, as you said, this is a hypothesis that you've come up with. If it's true, and I'm not here to question it at all, what does that tell us? Does it tell us something more or new or different about than dark matter?
It would say that dark matter, like our matter, is richer. It has an extra component. And this dark disk wouldn't just be present in our galaxy. It could be present elsewhere. So it's really saying that galaxies are shaped differently. So it's a whole new way of looking at the universe. And it's also a different way of looking for dark matter in the sense that so far we've observed dark matter gravitationally, but maybe it has these other effects that tell us about its interactions too.
Let me reintroduce you, and that's Lisa Randall, our guest in this hour of Radio Time. She's got a new book called Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs, The Astounding Interconnectedness of the Universe. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read a couple of emails. We have one from Thomas who says, please ask your guests if dark matter is around us here on Earth. If so, how could we measure it?
Great question. So yes, it's around us, and probably there's billions of dark matter particles passing through every second. Dark matter is all here, but it's hard to find because if it interacts only via gravity, that's a very, very weak force of an individual particle. It's only large amounts of dark matter that where we can observe the gravitational influence. However, there's a possibility that it does interact with ordinary matter at a higher level, not big enough that we've seen it, but maybe a tiny interaction. And there are proposals for those that kind of idea for dark matter. And those kind of searches are happening on Earth. For example, there's big vats of stuff deep underground in tunnels or mines to protect it from cosmic rays. And those are very, very sensitive. And furthermore, they really work hard to reject it from background radiation. So those have a possibility of detecting dark matter. There's xenon experiments, for example, that are looking very hard right now.
Let me get to, it looks like Joe from Allentown to join our conversation. Hi, Joe. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. How are you, Lisa? Thank you for a wonderful show.
Thank you.
My question is a simple one. Considering how little we know about dark matter and dark energy, are we speaking about the same ether that Michelson and Morley were attempting to discover or disprove in 1887? And if they're not the same thing, how are they different? And if they are, I mean, were Michelson and Morley were wrong then?
And you have to fill us in on who we're talking about here.
So this has to do with trying to – well, let me just first say that they weren't wrong. And that had to do with interactions of light and gravity as well. But the thing is that it's not the same in the sense that there's no fixed direction. I mean, that's one of the reasons we sort of knew there wasn't an ether. But this is just energy that's just spread throughout the universe. You can call it an ether if you want, but it's not the kind they were looking for. There's nothing wrong with having energy spread throughout the universe. You might think of it as a field or some. There's other things like a magnetic field. You can have a magnetic field without having actual matter. So dark energy is definitely present. And dark matter is definitely present. I mean, dark matter is really matter. So it's clumping where matter is. So there's nothing wrong about what was said before. Mm. And if you want to call this an ether, you can. But it doesn't really add to the discussion. So it's just stuff that's around.
And Michelson and Morley, they were sort of early on investigators?
Yeah, they were they were trying to see whether there was this ether, whether you can actually see a directionality when they did the study. And there was no evidence for it, and this was important for Einstein's theories.
What got you interested in particle physics, cosmology?
You know, I started off liking math and liking puzzle solving. But I didn't want to just do math. I preferred to do things that applied to the world. And so I ended up studying physics. But I like the kind of problems that you do. First of all, I do theory. I'm too messy and impatient to be an experimenter.
Is that right?
But I really love that there are experiments. I love that we do learn about the world. And I like having interactions more. So I don't like doing just abstract theoretical stuff that will never be tested. I like having the idea that there could be tests. But I like the type of work that you do. I like putting together different pieces, putting together different theories to see if we can find consistency to find explanations for things.
Did you find, I'm not sure how old you are, so I don't know whether you grew up in a time when, you know, girls were relegated to certain subjects and boys to others. Was that something?
Well,
that
I definitely remember girls having to do tap dancing while boys play basketball, which I really was not very happy about. As far as classes go, though, you know, we all took the same classes. And then it's a question of just sociology. I mean, I joke that, you know, I probably wasn't properly socialized because I didn't know I wasn't supposed to do it. You know,
that helps, doesn't it?
It helps in that respect.
But do you think, I'm almost hesitant to ask this, but do you think women scientists physicists ask different questions?
I think we're all asking the same questions. Right. But I do think that women and men do grow up in slightly different environments these days. I think it would be hard to deny that. And maybe it makes you, I mean, in an optimistic point of view, it makes you push a little bit harder. It makes you listen a little more carefully, maybe be a little bit less assured that people are going to listen to what you say. So that you have to really think it through and make sure what you're saying is solid. And, you know, when I write a book, I'm really careful to go over it a zillion times and to try to make it friendly, because I know that, you know, it's a little bit easier to attack. And
because you're a woman?
I think so. I mean, unfortunately, I think that's still true. And, you know, it's also easier to recognize and praise. I'm not saying there's not good things, too. But I think that I'd like to just think that it gives you higher standards. And also the fact that maybe you are a little bit of an outsider. I think it's really to what I was saying before. I think it helps to have different perspectives when you look at things. And so maybe it just makes you a little bit more open-minded.
This is such a cliche, and I was sharing this with you before we went on the air, but reading your book, and when I read other books about science, it, frankly, it depresses me about the bad education.
Not the book itself.
the fact that I don't know this stuff is so, it's embarrassing, frankly.
Well, you know, when a friend of mine read the book and said, you know, this book is great because it takes off where our high school education left off. And, you know, it's not like I learned all of this in high school either. And part of the great things about books is that they're a way to get introduced to all of this. I mean, the challenge is, of course, leaving out all the technical stuff, but still getting the basic concepts across. And that's actually a challenge, and creative challenge, that I enjoy. And I think people really are interested. And I think especially today, when we're contemplating what's happening to the planet, it's so useful and important to understand where it came from and to understand the complexity of the whole system.
Let me get, looks like Paul from Wildcrest, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Paul. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, indeed. Go ahead.
Okay. Last night, 60 Minutes had a segment about the super collider, the Large Hadron Super Collider, and colliding protons to produce evidence of dark matter. And it talked about Peter Higgs, who had done some math back in 1935, and the experimental data finally confirms what his equation showed. I'm just curious. It showed it showed him standing in front of a chalkboard, kind of like Sheldon on the Big Bang Theory TV show. And I wonder just what your work day is like, if it consists of doing math all day long, looking for a new equation, or putting new data into an equation that you already have. What's the work life of a particle physicist like?
Paul, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Just go ahead.
It's kind of all of the above. I mean, you know, we will sit down and have equations. I mean, whenever a photographer comes in, they always want to take pictures of my blackboard, which has tons of equations on it, and it's a nice big blackboard. But, you know, we'll also just meet in a common area and just bandy off ideas. There will be blackboards surrounding us so that we can write on the board if we need to. So we'll just discuss ideas. You know, sometimes I'll read what other people have done, or, you know, it depends. If I have a new idea for a model, I'll try to work out what the consequences will be. If there's some interesting new data, I mean, this work on dark matter was prompted by some data that we heard about it, and there was no explanation for it. So we're just testing out different ways of doing it. But then once you do that, then you try to figure out what other consequences there would be. And sometimes you have to reset. So sometimes it's in communication with others. Sometimes it's on your own. Sometimes it's sitting down at a desk. Sometimes it's reading things. It's really, I mean, I think different people work in different ways, but for me, it's really a combination.
What got you thinking about this dark matter and, I guess, dinosaurs? What got you thinking about
It was an indirect story. We were originally trying to explain some data where the rate of possible detection of dark matter, which turned out to go away. I don't want to mislead anybody. And we knew it would probably go away. But we wanted to say, you know, is there any possible way that you could have found this much? It turned out it was a photon signal. Could you have found this much? And, you know, we were playing around with different models, trying to explain why we would see it this way and not that way. And finally, we just thought, what if dark matter was just denser so that it annihilated more often? That is to say, dark matter met another dark matter particle and turned into photons more often. So we tried to think, like, could it be denser? We thought, well, the Milky Way, you know, if you think about it, it's amazing we're surrounded by ordinary matter because we just said it's 1/6 of the energy. But the fact is it collapsed into a disk. So we thought maybe dark matter could do the same. And then I have to admit, you know, I was not thinking about dinosaurs. But one of the great things, is, you know, is getting asked to give lots of talks, which can be great or it can be distraction. But I gave a talk in University of Arizona.
Arizona University.
Yeah, Arizona University. I always forget
not
which one.
Not sure.
Yeah. But Paul Davies was in the audience.
Oh, sure.
And he actually said, so this is this what killed the dinosaurs? And I was like a little bit taken aback. And so we went through and then I understood the whole story and started thinking. Mm-hmm. And my collaborator, Matt Reese, and I went back and really did a formal study to see what the periodicity could be and could it happen quickly enough and what would the effects be. I mean, we were, you know, at first, I have to say, it wasn't like we were like immediately like we're going to do this. It sounded a little bit wacky. And, you know, if you just say dark matter and dinosaurs, it does sound wacky in a fun kind of way. But what we realized is there's real science behind it because you can really do the statistics. You can really see is at least our periodic impacts. Is that a scientific thing that you can solidify? And so we figured out how to do the statistics in a way that that could be tested better and to figure out what are the parameters that you'd want and things like that, which really are science.
I mean, it sounds like the collaboration part of the work you do is pretty exciting. The fact that you can put heads together.
I think so because, you know, I have a friend who once said about academics, they're like the most confident and the most insecure people they know. And I think that's actually what you need to be a good scientist because you have to kind of believe in your idea enough to push it forward. But you also need to be wary and to think, you know, this idea is crazy. And why do we know this is true? It's why would we want to change everything we know to accommodate? There better be some strong evidence and it better be consistent. And I think, you know, if you have more than one person bouncing it back and forth, you're just going to reach that point sooner because you have the skeptics, but you also have the person pushing it forward and they could go back and forth. And so you can have alternative points of view.
So self-doubt is an important tool to have.
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, if you overbelieve in your ideas, you won't test it enough. You know, I mean, it prompts you to really think it through and think through what are the consequences. And, you know, sometimes throw away your ideas, sadly, but, you know, but also to think of better ones.
And that's Lisa Randall, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, author of a new book called Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs, The Astounding Interconnectedness of the Universe. She is a cosmologist and a theoretical particle physicist at Harvard University, where she is a professor of physics. And joining us on Radio Times, obviously, to talk about some of her findings, some of her ideas. And again, you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. And our guest, Lisa Randall, has a knack for making concepts like dark matter understandable to the general public. That's what we're talking about, her new book called Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs. An interesting possible explanation for the extinction of the dinosaurs involving dark matter. She studies theoretical particle physics and cosmology at Harvard University. Also the author of several other best-selling books, Knocking on Heaven's Door and Warped Passages. We had a caller talking about Higgs, and she wrote an e-book called Higgs Discovery, The Power of Empty Space. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You are also a librettist, if that weren't enough. And this is an opera called Hypermusic Prologue.
A projective opera in seven planes.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, no,
Where did this come from?
Very fortunate. You know, after I wrote my first book called Warp Passages, I'd spent a lot of time trying to put together many different ideas that enter into the kind of research we do, starting, you know, from gravity and quantum, but working our way to particle physics and string theory. It was really all in there. And it was a lot of work trying to turn it into a linear story. And then out of the blue, a composer, a lot of people wrote to me afterward, and, you know, some with creative ideas. And a composer, a young composer at ERCOM, associated with the Pompidou Center, a young Spanish composer named Hector Parra contacted me. And he had this idea for an opera. And it was funny because I thought about art, but I'd never thought about an opera. And he really wrote a long, thoughtful email. He clearly really did understand stuff. And I sent some samples of his music. And I thought, you know, this is a great idea.
Yeah.
Because opera, you know, it's just understated, just the opportunity. You have music, you have words, you have sets, you have people, you have different lines of music. And it seemed like a great way to get concepts of physics across and also just concepts of creativity. And we ended up coming up with an idea that was premiered at the Pompidou Center and went to several other places. It's very, very modern electronic music. But it was kind of a nice way to really try to present the idea of like the disparity between being here and exploring, say, another dimension, which he was very excited about for his music, too.
And writing for music as you as the librettist, right?
Yeah, it was definitely a different kind of challenge. It was pretty funny.
And someone plays you in this opera, as I understand
it. No, that's not true. People make this up.
Oh, okay. Well, let me ask you. No?
No, there's just two characters. I mean, there are only so many plots that you can have. We didn't have that many singers. So there's two characters. There's one is a composer, but also a scientist. And she goes out and explores another dimension, but also to try to resolve some issues with her music. The other is someone who's more entrenched in three dimensions, and he stays in three dimensions. And it's sort of a, you know, about their communication, trying to understand the world and thinking, you know, is it that something's missing inside or is there something missing out there? And I think that's sort of the dilemma we all face.
Indeed. Well, we just pulled a clip from this opera. This is Hypermusic Prologue, Plane 2, Questioning Reality, A Wonderful Place, with our guest Lisa Randall as librettist.
Wonderful place, wonderful place, incomparable. It's enough. I can explain harmonic rhythmic scales. Newton tells you where the ball will. Relates to energy's tensor. You question basic beliefs.
What's the building?
Deviations from the path.
Hector Parra's Hypermusic Prologue and our guest Lisa Randall as librettist. That is, first of all, it's really wild and fascinating, but you do get a sense of just the kind of vastness of space somehow.
Well, I think that was the idea, to sort of get this sense of exploration to go out there. I should say, you know, Hector probably had me put more physics in than I would have done myself. He really wanted that for his music. And, you know, he really, you know, had the last word. So he said, you know, short phrases, sort of the style. But I did like the idea of, you know, and it was really interesting even seeing the people at the Pompidou Center get won over to this idea of presenting physics. By the end, I was uncertain. They were like, no, this is great. This is a really good thing to do. And it is just a different way of presenting ideas. And it was really fun to see the audience reaction. It was, and, you know, we were also just extremely fortunate. We had the best performers. We had Ensemble Into Contemporain. Wow. We had these wonderful singers.
Wow.
So it was really nice to see this.
And the audience reaction was enthusiastic.
It was really enthusiastic. And we also had the artist Matthew Ritchie, who did set. So we were also really lucky about that. And so, yeah, I think people were fascinated. You know, it's a lot. I mean, there's a lot of abstraction. It was abstract art, abstract ideas, abstract physics, abstract music. So it can be a little bit overwhelming, but I think it was also very beautiful at times. And I think people were excited about it. They knew they'd experienced something different.
Are you an opera buff yourself?
I know opera buffs, so I would not.
Oh, you know.
I mean, I like opera, but I'm not at the level of some of the people I know who are really aficionados.
Let me get Kate from Morristown to join us. Hi, Kate. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you. I'd like to ask Professor Randall to comment on how theoretical physicists, are going after the information on dark matter, especially as regards the Schrödinger equation, wave function, and superposition.
Fair enough, Kate. Thanks for the call.
Quantum mechanics is an underlying tool in sort of everything we're doing in particle physics. I mean, we really do what's called quantum field theory, which combines together quantum mechanics and special relativity, and it's a way we do particle physics. So it's sort of intrinsic. It's understood that quantum mechanics is part of the theory. So really what we're focusing on is sort of what is the nature of dark matter in the sense of, you know, what is its mass, which of course, you know, has something to do with the way that, but that we're just looking at the mass at this point. We're looking at it as a particle. We're saying, what is the mass? What are the interactions? Does it have any charges at all? Does it have any interactions with our form of matter aside from gravitational? Does it have its own interactions? So we're more focused on those questions. The other stuff is sort of just almost like background tools.
Okay, thanks for the call. Let me see what Joanna from Jeffersonville has to say. Hi, Joanna. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. My question is, when you described this narrow band of transparent or dark matter that might affect the solar system every 30 million years, I thought of some of the research they've done taking pictures of Charon and Pluto, New Horizons, when scientists said that there is evidence on the moon, Charon, of melting, of the restructuring of the surface of the moon maybe a million years ago. And my question is, could that possibly be evidence of something disrupting that created that much heat a million years ago or so in the outer solar system? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Joanna, thanks for the call.
So I talk a lot about the structure of the solar system in this book, and so New Horizons is exploring the Kuiper Belt, which is right outside Neptune, and is maybe near the scattered disk, which is a source of short period comets, and it's about 30 times as far away as the Earth is from the Sun. So what I'm talking about is the Oort cloud, much further away. There's all sorts of impacts that can happen, and I also discuss the effects that various impacts can have, and there is even some evidence that the impact that I'm talking about, the one that happened 66 million years ago, could have triggered enhanced volcanic activity. So, there's a lot of stuff happening. There's sort of internal geology. There's stuff that's hitting. And so we're just beginning to understand what's causing these sort of massive changes. And so it could have to do with the external environment, but probably the first place to look is in the internal environment, and then but then also see, could there have been other effects that could have mattered.
Joanna, thanks for the call. An email from Michael. He said, I read an article about how we're at a point in technology where we can measure expansion rates of the universe, but I've also heard that these expansion rates can supersede technology. Can you discuss this?
I'm not sure exactly what you're asking, but I'm just going to say that you're probably saying that measuring dark energy parameters in more detail is hard. That is to say, knowing with precision what it is that's accelerating the universe, knowing has it changed with time. I mean, every measurement that we're doing is almost by definition challenging because it's one we haven't done before. So we're sort of always, the Large Hadron Collider that was brought up before is at the edge of looking at the highest energies. I mean, we're always looking at stuff that hasn't been looked at before, which means you're going to be at the edge of technology. And so that means things take longer to develop, they get more expensive, and it gets harder to study. But that's where we are with dark energy and everything else.
An email from Tom. Is there any data that dark matter decays? Could dark matter have been involved in the early expansion of the universe, especially the acceleration inflationary phase?
In terms of decaying dark matter, that's one of the things people look at. And so we do model building. That's a possible model, having dark matter that decays. We don't know if it does or not. You'd have to have enough of it around that you could still measure it. So you'd have to have enough energy stored in it. In the early universe, that's actually what distinguishes dark matter and dark energy. The dark energy of the early universe is different than the dark energy we have now in the sense that there was a lot more of it. It was a much bigger amount of energy. But matter is not going to create an acceleration of the expansion. And that's kind of what people had been looking for originally. This expansion is really a different kind of thing. I mean, we're calling it dark energy now, but it used to be known more like a cosmological constant, some vacuum energy that's present and that doesn't involve matter. It's not stuff that clumps together. It's a smooth, continuous thing. And what's really weird about it is that as the universe expands, its energy density remains the same. That's not true of ordinary matter. It's not true of radiation. All that stuff dilutes as the universe expands. This is an energy density that remains constant over the expansion until, of course, inflation ends.
You have a chapter, Socially Connected Dark Matter, making some interesting analogies here. You begin the chapter saying urbanization has been vital to many of the advances of modern life and talk about how cities have grown and then the suburbs get created. And then you write, it turns out the same general pattern might apply to the growth of structure in the universe.
Yeah, so I did have a lot of fun with all these analogies. This one's a little bit tricky in the sense that I was trying to motivate something called interacting dark matter. And that has to do with the fact that if you model what dark matter would do in terms of creation of structure, well, the first thing I should take a step back and say, I mean, probably most people don't realize this, but dark matter was essential to the creation of structure in the lifetime of our universe for two reasons. One is that there's just more of it. Mm-hmm. So it meant that structure formation could start happening sooner. And the second is that because it doesn't interact with light, structures on smaller sizes don't get washed out the way it would with ordinary matter where radiation could wash it out. So dark matter plays a really important role in structure formation. And it works extremely well on large scales. If you look at the statistics of large objects, it matches what's predicted. On small scales, it's not as clear that that's what happens. And it looks like the densities at the centers might be slightly different. And this is a motivation that there could be what's known as interacting dark matter, self-interacting dark matter. And so I was just trying to do structurally the analogy to a city where if it gets too dense in the center, it kind of explodes and has to spread out. And the same sorts of things could be happening in the dark matter world.
Do you struggle with the fact that there are people that think the world, the Earth is 6,000 years old?
I get great emails from them.
Do you? What kind of emails?
Oh, just yesterday I got one saying that that the extinction of the dinosaurs had to do with Noah and, you know, not.
Right. But how do you deal with that? I mean, as
The only way I can deal with it, which is to try to educate people. I'm joking now, and that's a little bit mean. But I do think there's information out there. People should have access to this information. If they choose not to view the information, that's not my fault. But what is my responsibility at some level is to have it out there in ways that they can understand. And so I do like to think, I don't think you're going to change everybody's mind, but I do like to think, and maybe this is very optimistic, that people who have more information will understand things better and make better decisions, better choices. And that's one of the reasons I think it is important to get ideas out there.
Let me get one more caller on. It looks like Mr. Puddle is calling us from Pennsylvania. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Do we have him? Nope. All right. Let me see if I can get Jack from Robbinsville to join us. Hi, Jack. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. My question is about individuals who experience an awareness of a current event that may be happening, a sixth sense as a sort, as how that might have a correlation with dark matter. Or sometimes I've heard stories of law enforcement using psychics to help them solve crime. Is dark matter a part of explaining why these individuals or the sixth sense?
Well, so first of all, I'm not a believer in a sixth sense. Right. I think that people might figure things out. And, there's a lot of people out there. Sometimes people might figure out surprising things. You know, you have to do a lot of statistics before you can show something like that is true. The other thing is that, there's a lot of stuff that I study that's just out there. And so people try to put it all together. My first book was an experiment. I mean, the fact is there's just a lot of stuff we don't understand about human psychology, and we have to understand that better. And I really don't think a psychic solving a crime is going to hold up in a court of law. I think there has to be real concrete evidence.
In fact, it doesn't hold up in a court of law.
Yeah, well, that's basically what I'm saying.
Yeah, I hear you.
Thank you. And so, it's, I think people want to believe that things are, that there are shortcuts, that it's easier. But the fact is, really figuring stuff out takes a while.
Well, and we're almost out of time here. But also, what I hear from you is that there's so much we don't know. And the danger or perhaps the risk is sort of using like sixth sense or something or something that sort of fill in those blanks.
The other thing is that I think we've solved problems. We have a tendency to think we can solve all problems, but we should solve one problem at a time. And I think you need a sort of more long term, more encompassing view when you try to think about big problems. So what I just think is that we should have. It's kind of an optimistic point of view in the sense that we can figure out so much. But I also like the fact that there's a lot left for us to understand. I think we have to be aware of that. And that's one of the things I want to get across.
Well, Lisa Randall, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. The book is called Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs and is subtitled The Astounding Interconnectedness of the Universe. And she is a theoretical particle physicist and cosmologist at Harvard University, author of a couple of other books, including bestsellers Knocking on Heaven's Door and Warped Passages. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our newsletter, listen on satellite radio. Diana Allen, our intern this year. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.